Hi, I'm Nancy Clare, and thank you for joining me and Lee Goldberg for the 140th episode of Speaking of Mysteries. I have to confess that I was so enthused at the prospect of speaking to Lee that I broke the cardinal rule of audio coverage and completely neglected to mention the title of the book we were discussing. The title is True Fiction, and it is the first installment in Lee's new series featuring Ian Ludlow, thriller writer turned espionage investigator. So please remember, as we talk about the characters in the plot, that we're talking about True Fiction, out now from Amazon's Thomas and Mercer. Here's Lee Goldberg to talk about True Fiction and so much more. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm delighted to have Lee Goldberg, to use the word prolific is to understate the word's meaning, a prolific author who has just introduced a new series, I believe, with Ian Ludlow. Welcome, Lee.
It's great to be here.
So let me get this right. You've written a book whose main protagonist is a former TV screenwriter who has become a successful writer of thrillers, who finds himself in situations that his fictional hero, Clint Straker, might find himself in. Sort of close to home for Lee Goldberg, screenwriter turned thriller writer, isn't it?
They say write what you know. So I thought I would take people up on that. The book came out of me being tired of reading novels and seeing movies about guys thrown into horrific, dangerous situations who succeed because they have hidden skills. They know parkour or martial arts, or they're ex-CIA or ex-Navy SEALs or secretly studied medicine or the children of some mystic cult, whatever. I thought it'd be much more fun to have a hero who's like one of us, who just gets thrown into a horrible situation and has no special skills and still has to survive. But at the same time, I'm also really amused by the fact that these heroes that I was just describing are written by schlubs like me who have no special skills, you know, who could barely tie their shoes. I love Lee Child, but he's not Jack Reacher, not by any stretch. So I thought it'd be fun to take somebody who spends their days creating situations for these superheroes, these wonderful athletic action-adventure stars, and put them in the same situations and see what happens.
Well, and I would say, because at least at the beginning of the book, Ian Ludlow is far from the, like, super operative archetype. I mean, he's got a cast on his right arm in the beginning.
And that was also taken from my life. There was a period where I was executive producing a TV show called Missing for Lifetime and also writing monk novels, and I had a terrible accident. I tripped over the handicap ramp at McDonald's and broke both of my arms. I had to keep producing these shows and stuff. And I just decided to take that predicament that I was in and put my hero in at least 50% of the same predicament.
Well, you put his sidekick into exactly the same predicament because she talks to Ian about having broken both her arms, it was playing soccer.
And the other motivation for this was I was having dinner with Lawrence Block once. How's that for name dropping?
Well done.
He was telling me about, and I wish I could remember the name of the author, but there was an author who'd written like 50 terrific detective novels who had his identity stolen or somebody had stolen something from him, and the police weren't helping him out, and he didn't know what to do next. And Lawrence Block said to him, but you're the author of the Reddington Blue detective novels, and Reddington Blue is absolutely brilliant, and Reddington Blue is a detective genius. Why don't you just approach this the way Reddington Blue does? And the guy said, but I'm not Reddington Blue. Yes, you are. Everything that hero has done, every situation he's been in, you created. You have the same intellectual skills as your character. No, I don't. And I became fascinated by that notion, too, that although Lee Child may not actually be Jack Reacher, he knows how to think like Reacher because every thought Reacher's ever had started with Lee first. It also goes back to a situation I had on a TV show once. I was doing a show called She-Wolf of London, and the female lead of the show once confronted me and told me I had no clue what her character was about. I understood nothing about her character. And I said, everything your character has ever done, every word your character has ever spoken, started with me. So I guess I could also channel a female werewolf.
Well, a skill that might come in handy going forward.
It does. It does, especially as a father.
What's happened that sets Ian on his high-stakes adventure is actually something he dreamed up in an exercise for the intelligence community, which goes to one of your points. And what tips him off that all is not right is when a plane crashes into a hotel in Waikiki. Call me as big a conspiracy theorist as Ronnie, who shows up later in the book. But I have a feeling that of our 17 or so spy organizations, the ones that we know about, they do similar things. They dream up doomsday scenarios.
Well, that's all based on reality. Lee Child, Brad Meltzer, several other authors I know, and many TV writers I know, have been asked by the CIA and Homeland Security to spitball terrorism scenarios because they aren't clever. The intelligence agencies aren't clever enough to anticipate these things on their own. They're bureaucrats. They don't have the imagination. So they go to Hollywood writers and graphic artists and other creative types to come up with the most outlandish scenarios they can so that the government can prepare for them. And this isn't just after 9/11. This goes back to World War II.
Right.
It's been going on in Hollywood for a very long time. So I sort of co-opted that truth and used it as the basis for my book. What if a writer did one of those spitballing sessions with a bunch of other writers for the CIA, forgot about it, and then 3 years later, 4 years later, one of the scenarios he came up with happens. So he calls up the other writers who were at that spitballing session with him and finds out, oh, my God, they're all dead, and realizes that his own streak of recent bad luck has been the CIA trying to kill him, and he goes on the run. It's sort of, you know, 6 days of the Condor, North by Northwest, mixed with a little of the Bourne Identity.
On the other hand, though, and one of the questions, one of the suggested questions that came along with your press material, of course, all of which I'm going to ignore, except for one thing, many of the surveillance elements that were utilized to track Ian Margo, who is the young woman he inadvertently gets hooked up with, and she has to stick with him, otherwise she'll die, and Ronnie, who shows up later, are real, like the RFID chips and surveillance cameras. All of that exists.
I believe in getting the reader or the viewer to suspend their disbelief. And the way to do that is to put just enough truth in your outlandish story that they can buy into it and believe it. So, yes, the technological underpinnings of the story are all true. Now, I may take them to some extremes, but when you have that basis of reality, you can get away with murder. TV shows do it all the time, whether it's Boston Legal or CSI or Law and Order. They do ridiculous things with the law and evidence, but because they have enough truthful stuff in there, you go along for the ride.
Right, and of course, we without spoiling the story, we can say that Ronnie is a former TV actor who has slightly gone off the rails, something that's not unusual. You and I both live in Southern California. I live in Sherman Oaks. You live further west. Many of our neighbors are deeply, deeply strange former television actors.
Oh, it has nothing to do with neighbors. I've worked with these actors.
Well, you've actually worked with
them. I've done a lot of television, and Ronnie's sort of an amalgamation of Fred Dreyer, David Hasselhoff, the woman who starred in She-Wolf of London. You know, so many actors I've worked with. They're the worst qualities, all crammed together into one. But I also made him likable because,
right.
I won't mention this, but I worked with an actor that was pretty much insane. And my job on the show was to basically hold his hand. Whenever there was a problem with the actor, they would call me to come down and deal with him. And you know, he was a messed up guy. He was a very good actor, but he was a messed up guy. And so and he irritated the hell out of me, but I also found him very endearing, almost childlike. So I gave Ronnie some of those qualities, too, that I made him irritating and outlandish and difficult. But at the same time, I hope I made him a little sympathetic as well.
Well, he's very likable, very sympathetic. You know, you are a talent whisperer.
I worked with a psychopathic producer once who was convinced the network and studio had us under constant surveillance. He would go at the end of the day to every writer's office and take their trash because he was afraid the studio and the network were going to come through and see the thrown away pages and outlines and stuff and to intimate what we were doing, you know, figure out what we were up to. It was insane, absolutely insane. He back when cell phones were the size of briefcases, he kept one in the desk drawer of my desk for people trying to reach him. It was just, he was a nutball, and I had to hold his hand as well.
Well, and of course, nowadays, the studios could just hack the computers to see the scripts, so there you go.
Yeah. So why would they want to? Ooh, we have to see the latest draft of the New Adventures of Flipper before it gets in our hands.
Well, you know, sometimes paranoia, you know, sometimes people really are out to get you, so there you go.
That's true.
But you're a funny guy. We've been on a panel together, and I know you for the funny guy that you are. And I appreciate the humor in almost all the life or death situations, and especially the ones that Ian, and by extension Maggie, the dog walker, find themselves in. But what do you say to the critical reader who says to you or tweets to you or emails you or posts in a review, this isn't funny? People really do die from these sorts of situations. Kind of a variation of, it's all fun and games until somebody loses an eye.
I have had that criticism, and there's humor in everything. Everything. Even in the worst situations of your own life. I can pull out examples from my own life. Like the day my mom died, which is a horrible day. And you know, she was dying, and the doctor said, she's not going to survive the day, get your family here. And I got my family there from all over the Western United States, and they got there just before she died, and she died with all of us in the room with her. And the pastor of the hospital came in and said, would you like me to say a few words? We're not a religious family, but my sister said, please, go ahead, say a few words. So the pastor, you know, gave a little spiel, and when he was done, he said, so how was that? And my sister said, it was very nice, thank you. And the pastor went, yes, yes, I knew it, yes! Starts doing this victory dance around the hospital room, and we're just staring at him. And he said, oh, excuse me, I've been away for 3 years, this is my first death. Since I got back, I wasn't sure if I still had my mojo, but I still got it. Thank you all. You've been wonderful. Sorry for your loss. And he left. And we just broke out laughing, and it was perfect for my mom. She would have loved it. And my brother said, I have dibs on this. My brother's an author, too. He wanted to use it. But you know, the worst situation, I told you that story about me breaking both of my arms. And I was in the emergency room, and the doctor, you know, told my wife, your husband has two broken arms, he's not going to be able to do anything for himself. My wife, who's French, goes, yes, yes, I understand. And the doctor says, I'm sure you do. He's not going to be able to do anything for himself. It's just, okay, I got it. No. Let me make this very clear. It's going to be like your husband is in a straitjacket. He's not going to be able to do anything for himself for quite a while. This is long silence. My wife says, would it be possible for him to go on a liquid diet? It's a horrible situation, but you know, she found the humor. And I'm a firm believer that even in life's most dire situations, I can look to my own life, you find humor. And look at the movies we love, whether it's the early James Bond films or the Star Wars movies or in Terms of Endearment. There's always humor. It goes along with tragedy and danger and anxiety. Frankly, I find movies that are humorless and books that are humorless totally unrealistic and unsatisfying. I find them kind of cold and distant. So, yes, I believe humor has a place. The danger is when the humor is not in balance with the drama. I was constantly afraid as I wrote this book that I was tipping too far into spoof because I did not want it to be Austin Powers. I wanted it to work as a thriller while at the same time poking fun at thrillers and being funny. I still wanted to have the adrenaline rush. I still wanted it to be fun. And I feel like, just looking at the reviews the book has gotten so far, that I succeeded, and that's a big relief.
Well, I must say I personally enjoyed, once again, without introducing spoilers, you have a high-speed chase in Southern California, in Los Angeles, in the Valley, which is where I live, and it's, you know, you make some very astute observations about that, meaning that everything stops when there's a high-speed chase. You know, there all sorts of things can be going on all over the world, but if someone's going the wrong way on the 101 in Tarzana, you stop and watch. You can't help yourself.
The entire newscast, I think it was two or three nights ago, was devoted to a police chase that was absolutely unexciting. Yet they ditched the entire night's news. Every station in L.A. was following that car. And it happens all the time. It's an L.A. cliche. And I decided to use that to my benefit.
And it works. But I mentioned in the introduction that you are a prolific writer, which is understating the meaning of the word prolific. And over your career, your output has been remarkable. And writing isn't the only facet of storytelling in which you're involved, though. You also, with a partner, have a publishing company called Brash Books. And some might say you have a lot of energy, and I think that's true. And I also have more than a little admiration for you because you understand that storytelling is a business. And I wanted to ask you about that because people, you know, I'm a writer as well, and all writers have had people come up to them and say, oh, you know, I'd love to write, and that's great. But if you want to make it your living, it's got to be a business. So I wanted to ask you about that because you have really made it a business.
Well, it is a business. I haven't made it one. It's always been a business. The writers who don't recognize that fact and don't learn about the business are doing themselves a horrible disservice. They're dooming their careers. You have to approach it like a business. And you know, I don't wait till I have the perfect temperature of in my office and the right music playing to write. I write whenever and wherever I can because that's how I make my living. I don't wait for the muse to strike. I sit my ass down in the chair and I do it. But I also make it a point to understand how the business works, to understand my contracts, to understand book distribution, to understand covers, to understand how e-books are affecting print books, and not because I now have a publishing company, but because it's my living. The same way that in television, you are forced as a writer to understand the business because your scripts are actually blueprints. They're production documents that other professionals, directors, location scouts, set builders, whatever, have to use to do their jobs. So you have to have a real understanding of production in order to write a script that not only is entertaining, but that can be shot in 7 days on the show's budget with the actors who are signed with their own unique limitations. So it's being a TV writer, I guess, in some ways, it forced me to be more focused on the business aspects of the books that I write. I don't sit down and write a book from a mercenary point of view saying, here's what's popular now, or here's what's going to sell, because it'll be 7-8 months before the book is done, and then another year before the book is out. So you can't work that way. You just have to be creative and look at the marketplace in a long view, not what's really successful at the moment. But Brash Books was born, frankly, out of some of my colleagues' inability to understand the business. I had taken, this is early in the days of the Kindle, I think around 2009, I'd taken my out-of-print backlist and put it on the Kindle and had a great deal of success at it. And so did my friend Joel Goldman. And another friends of mine who had great out-of-print books were not succeeding in putting their books out on the Kindle. And at conferences and book signings and other industry events, authors were constantly coming up to me and Joel and saying, can I buy you a drink and pick your brain about how you're doing what you're doing? And we were always glad to do it. But ultimately, I'd say 9 out of 10 of those authors who came up to us never followed through because they just didn't have the energy or the commitment to do what was necessary to make their out-of-print books a success. And there was an author who had passed away, and I loved his books, and I wanted to bring them back. So I figured I could do for those books what I had done for my own, and I contacted the dead author's estate and was negotiating with them on their books. And I went to Joel, who's a lawyer, to ask his legal advice on how to bring these books back and what to ask for in the deal. And this is at a conference where he and I were being bombarded by fellow authors wanting to know the secret sauce behind putting their out-of-print books back into print. And Joel looked at me and he said, you know, this is a business plan. We could be very successful at this. my first thing was, we? What's your business plan? He said, we should start a company. We could take the best crime fiction ever published and bring it back. And I said, that's pretty brash. There's our title, Brash Books. And we've now been in business 4 years. We've put out 100 titles, and it's been going very well. The one thing it's not is a vanity press. None of our own books are published by Brash Books. We never want our authors to believe or fear that they were competing with us for promotional consideration and other resources. So it's a standalone company, has nothing to do with my writing or Joel's. It's just about bringing out terrific new books and also great books that have fallen out of print.
And I think you do a good job. I know my friend Dick Lochte, who I worked with at Los Angeles Magazine, is with Brash Books.
And he was one of the guys that came up to us and said, yeah, how did you do this? And so then we went back to him a couple of days later and said, if we were to start a publishing company, would you let us take your book and do this for you in exchange for a percentage of the royalties? He went, done. And we've had a great deal of success with Sleeping Dog and Laughing Dog. And it's been a real honor to republish those books.
And, you know, I think that it's not from lack of intelligence or anything else that many writers find themselves writers sort of by, it's almost like a serendipity. Someone says, that's a great story, why don't you write a book? Or you've done something else, you've been a lawyer, airline pilot, cop, lawyer, any number of professions, and suddenly you find yourself out of work and you write a book. And I think that what you've done is shown writers that although it's work, it's all work. Writing is work. The business side is not really this mysterious thing. That's where I think transparency is good.
Well, it's also essential. You know, read your contract. Understand what you're signing. Understand what the terms mean. When you sign with an editor at a publishing company, fly to New York or Seattle or wherever they are, meet them. Go to conferences. Spend time with other editors and agents and authors. Talk shop. Learn about how the business works. When you go to a bookstore and you're killing time, ask the bookseller questions about sales, about what books are working, what's not. What's the relationship like with your distributor? What's the difference between Ingram and Baker and Taylor? How does special ordering work? Ask things about the business that will affect how your book is positioned and sold. Because writing the book is only half the job. The other half is selling it and making sure it's a success. And it's vitally important. You shouldn't treat books any differently than if you're a lawyer becoming an author, how you treat a case, or if you're an airline pilot becoming an author, how you'd fly a plane and what you learn about air flight and how the business works and how the science works and the mechanics of the plane work. It's a business. It's art, but it's also a business because you expect to be paid. You want to make a living at it. You want royalties. You better understand the forces that impact those.
So just because you know one business and you might have been a good lawyer who understood contracts and how a case worked and how you could litigate and all that, this is different. Writing a book is completely different from writing a magazine article.
It's very different. And one of the great things about running a publishing company now is I have a better understanding of the publishing companies that publish my books and what forces are working on them. And it impacts my negotiations. I haven't had a literary agent for my books for about 6 or 7 years. I've been doing my own deals. And it's great. I roll up my sleeves and I get into it. I know exactly what my contracts say and what I can expect from my publisher. And I maintain a very close relationship with my publishers. I go to dinners with them. I talk to them on the phone. I talk to their marketing people. I talk to the cover artists. I know what's going on. I don't, like so many authors, just write the book, send it out into the void, and hope it succeeds. And I also don't wait for an agent to find me work. I generate my own work. Now, TV's different. I wouldn't dare do a lot of this stuff without my TV agent. I've had the same television agent for almost 30 years. It's a much more complicated business than books. A publishing contract is a lot less complicated than a TV contract. But I think it's very important. And if you look at the authors who succeeded, if you look at Lee Child, for instance, you won't find a smarter man about the publishing business, or Janet Ivanovich, or Michael Connelly. These guys, or Brad Meltzer, these guys know the business inside and out. They've been to the distribution centers. They've talked to all the legal affairs people. They've talked to booksellers. They've talked to distributors. They know exactly what's going on. And that's vitally important to your long-term success, to your brand, to your relationship with readers and booksellers.
So, you know, I just have one caveat for writers that are just getting going, that are listening, that you often need a literary agent when you're starting out.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I would not recommend it for someone just starting out. You have to learn. I mean, I've been at this for a very long time. My first book was sold and published when I was 19. So I've had a literary agent for many, many, many years, decades, in fact. So, no, I would not recommend, and you know, Janet Ivanovich and Lee Child and Mike Connelly, they all have agents. If I were doing business at their level, I would probably go back to an agent, too. But it's also a difference between what they're earning and what I'm earning, which plays into it. I'd rather keep that 15%, even though I'm probably making some mistakes and not getting as good a deal as I might get if I had an agent negotiating for me. You need to learn before you can start asserting yourself. You don't want to get into the distribution questions and cover questions and all that before you know what you're talking about, because then you're just irritating.
Sometimes
I'm probably irritating too, but I'm probably irritating.
Sometimes when you do know what you're talking about, especially with covers, I think my publisher probably wanted to find me and kill me.
Well, I'll give you an example from my own career. I wrote a book that came out in 1996 called Beyond the Beyond. And the cover showed up in the mail, and I looked at it, and I was horrified. And I called my editor, and I said, I just got the cover. And he said, what'd you think? I said, it's horrible. It will kill the book. Well, why do you say that? I said, because there's a giant steel penis on the cover. And my editor said, that's not a penis. It's a rocket ship. And I said, I've seen rocket ships, I own a penis, and I'm telling you, it's a steel penis, and it's against a piss-yellow backdrop. No bookstore in America is going to sell this book cover out. You are killing my book before it comes out. And my editor at St. Martin's Press said, we are St. Martin's Press. We've been doing this for 100 years. Trust us, we know what we're talking about. You write the books, you let us handle everything else. So sure enough, they sent me on a nationwide press book tour. And every bookstore I went to, the bookseller said, we can't put this book out. It's got a giant penis on the cover. And the book died. So ever since then, I've made sure to make my opinion known about the covers, because publishers don't always know what they're talking about. And if they do disagree with me about a cover, they better be able to explain to me why I'm wrong. You know, why. And I won't give you a specific example, but there was one where I didn't like on a book, and my publisher explained why they liked it, what demographic they were going for, how it was going to look on in a thumbnail versus the other cover they had in mind. And when I understood their thinking, their strategy behind it, I thought, okay, well, yeah, all right, let's take a shot. And they were right. I just don't want to reveal which cover I didn't like. Beyond the Beyond, you guys can go look it up on Google. They actually use that cover now in book cover illustration classes, an example of what not to do with a book cover. It's horrible in every way.
Just to you live to become a case study, I know. So I have one more question, and I really enjoyed the book, and I enjoyed Ian Ludlow because he was so many writers that I know that live this vicarious life, myself included. But I'm hoping that Ian, along with Margot, the ex-dog walker, is not a one and done. So
no, the sequel is already written, copy edited, and I've seen the drafts of the cover. The book is coming
which
out
you like.
In February of 2019.
Well, that's terrific. Thank you so much, Lee, for talking to us. And if you want to see more of Lee, I believe there is a video about the new book out, and the link will be on the website, on the Speaking of Mysteries website. So thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.